I thought I was just telling stories. Fictional villains, made-up crimes, dramatized corruption. But then the emails started. The offshore accounts were real. The victims had names. And the characters I created? They were watching me. This isn't just a podcast anymore. It's a war against the syndicate that's been laundering murder through media and feeding the public carefully curated lies. I'm not here to entertain. I'm here to expose, before they erase me too. Welcome to the investigation they never wanted you to hear. This is Unlocking the Secrets of the Fictional Faces of Evil. Oh, by the way, if you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. The first fictional face. They say fiction is safer than the truth. But no one ever told me that fiction can bleed. It started like all my projects do. Late at night. Too much caffeine. And a stubborn refusal to quit. I had this idea. A dark little twist on the classic true crime podcast formula. Instead of rehashing overexposed cases, I'd create them. Seven killers. Seven fictional masterminds. Each a mirror to the corruption I'd seen as a former journalist. I'd call it the fictional faces of evil. It was supposed to be smart. It was supposed to be safe. And it was supposed to be fake. But the first face I gave life to wasn't mine to invent. Episode 1. Ronan Vale, billionaire crypto cultist. Publicly, he ran a tech foundation that uplifted youth through blockchain. Privately, he used shell companies and offshore accounts to bribe politicians, traffic power, and manipulate media narratives, all while hiding behind a guru-like charm and a fleet of rented orphans for photo ops. I built him from scratch, or so I thought. A Frankenstein of Elon, Epstein, and half a dozen faceless elites. I even included fake financial data, forged donor lists, made up corporate structures. But 2 days after the episode aired, I got a DM. Not fiction. Not safe. Stop digging. It was sent from an anonymous account with no followers. Deleted 5 minutes later. I should have brushed it off. But something felt off. The voice in my gut, the one I'd spent years silencing, screamed, "Pay attention." So I did what I wasn't supposed to. I reopened my laptop and began reverse searching every name I thought I invented. And that's when I saw it. Vale Technologies LLC, a registered Cayman Islands corporation since 2018. My fictional company existed. My first thought was coincidence. Second thought, lawsuit. Third thought, they're real. I dove deeper. Ronan Vale was a character I imagined as a hybrid of tech genius and cult leader. But buried in obscure white papers and defunct Reddit threads were whispers of someone almost identical. Real-world photos, closed investigations, a suicide tied to Enlightenment retreats. No mainstream coverage. No official charges. Just a pile of unanswered questions smothered by legal threats and bureaucracy. I started mapping timelines, matching names. The deeper I went, the more shadows of justice I uncovered. Real victims behind fake smiles, donations that disappeared, children who never got their scholarships. Lives ended in what were ruled natural causes, even when the autopsies told a different story. I was shaking by the time I finished my research. This wasn't an algorithm glitch. This was a trail. And then came the second message. You think you're a storyteller, but you're an informant. Choose carefully. That night, I unplugged everything. No Wi-Fi, no smart speaker, no phone. I pulled my podcast episodes offline, claiming audio corruption. But the truth? I was spiraling. This project wasn't fiction anymore. It was a sinister case, and I had stepped into the crosshairs. I went to the police. A mistake. They took notes, smiled politely, and filed it under online harassment. They didn't even glance at the printouts of corporate filings or the map I built with yarn and thumbtacks. When I mentioned offshore laundering, one officer literally yawned. And when I said the words financial corruption, They asked if I had any proof that wasn't based on a podcast episode. I left with the bitter taste of red tape on my tongue. I'd forgotten how the system worked. Or rather, how it didn't. So I called someone I hadn't spoken to in years, Jules. Jules is the kind of person who keeps a second passport in her freezer and never uses the same VPN twice. She used to be a whistleblower for a major financial firm before she vanished. Now she only answers encrypted calls. I told her what happened. Silence. Then, "You're not imagining this. I know that name, and I've seen those files. But if you want the truth, you'll need to dig where they don't want you to." She sent me an address, an abandoned bookstore two towns over. Inside, taped beneath a loose floorboard, was a USB drive wrapped in an old Bookstagram sticker. The files on that drive? They weren't stories. They were evidence. Board meeting transcripts. Financial records. Leaked videos. True crime stories hiding in plain sight. The drive was titled Faces Unveiled. And Ronan Vale? He wasn't the only one. That was the moment I stopped being a storyteller. That was the moment I became a liability. Because fiction is safe. But unveiling the truth? That's a death sentence. Blood in the margins. They always say the devil's in the details, but I've learned the truth hides in the margins, buried beneath what we don't say, what we skim over, what we file away under fiction and move on from because it makes us too uncomfortable to look again. But I couldn't look away anymore. Not after what I found on that USB. I'd only scratched the surface of what Jules gave me. There were over 100 folders, most marked with strange aliases like The Console, Lily Black, and Chapter House. But the one that stood out was titled Ivy Thorne. I remembered her. Or rather, the character I thought I'd created. Episode 4 of Fictional Faces of Evil was about a woman who ran an underground self-help group for high-powered women. On the surface, she preached empowerment, community, wellness. But beneath that was a secret network of control, psychological abuse, and, as I'd written in my script, financial scams disguised as spiritual growth. The thing is, I wrote her as a twisted blend of scam influencers, wellness grifters, and MLM cult leaders. She was meant to be over the top, too theatrical to be real, and yet here she was. Real. Documented. Dangerous. The drive contained internal documents, legal filings, gag orders, even a dead woman's diary. Her name was Elise Caro, 41 years old, former tech consultant, divorced, lonely, vulnerable. She attended one of Ivy Thorne's restoration retreats in Ojai, California, after battling depression. Within 6 months, she'd sold her condo, cut off all contact with her family, and transferred $800, Zuro, into a light-working trust registered in, you guessed it, Belize. Offshore. Untraceable. Vanished. 3 weeks after the final transfer, she was found dead in her bathtub, ruled a suicide. No note. But her diary told another story. They said if I didn't align my vibrations, I'd block the collective's healing, that I was a financial bottleneck to our ascension. I feel poisoned. Not just by them, by myself. I handed over everything, and they told me I'd finally be free. Reading it felt like swallowing glass. Not because I was shocked, but because I wasn't. I'd seen these patterns before. When I was a reporter, I'd written about an influencer couple arrested for selling fake cancer cures. They vanished after 2 days of house arrest, never found. The case quietly disappeared from headlines. Back then, my editor killed the follow-up. It's not sexy. He said, no blood, no crime scene. No one wants to hear about financial corruption. But Elise? She bled. Just not in a way the system cared about. I started piecing together the links between Ivy Thorne and Ronan Vale. They shared offshore networks. The same shell company lawyer. Identical patterns of tax sheltering, gift laundering, and emotional exploitation, even a shared property on the outskirts of Malta, a crumbling villa listed under an art nonprofit that's never hosted a single event. It was all there, The paper trail. The shadows. The smirking faces behind sealed justice tales that never made it to court. But what chilled me most wasn't the crime. It was the silence. The way these sinister cases were written off, sealed behind bureaucracy and NDAs, buried beneath wealth, influence, and smiling press releases. I tried reaching out to the family of Elise Caro. No answer. But a private number called me back an hour later. Male voice. Flat. Professional. We know what you're doing. We advise you to stop. Think about your future. I hung up. Heart pounding. Hands sweating. But that's when I realized something terrifying. I was too deep to back out. I released a teaser for my next episode. Vague. Cryptic. Just enough to signal I wasn't done yet. Within the hour, I got an anonymous email with the subject line. She was supposed to stay fictional. Attached was a photo. Black and white. Grainy. But clear enough to see it was a woman. Bound and gagged. Seated in a hotel room, eyes wide. Tears smeared. She looked like... Ivy. But the timestamp? 4 days ago. I don't know if it's real. I don't know if it's a warning or a breadcrumb. But I know this. She's alive. And that means this story isn't over. This isn't just about one or two shadowy figures. It's a network. A syndicate that hides behind self-help language, content creation, and the illusion of fiction. Their crimes don't look like the ones you see on Dateline. They look like podcasts, books, wellness retreats, luxury donations, orchestrated true crime stories marketed as art. And maybe the scariest part? We love it. We consume it. We pay for it. We stream it. We let evil slip in dressed as content. I don't know what chapter 3 holds, but I'm done writing fiction. This is a real investigation now, and the next face I uncover might just be listening. The one who wrote the scripts. I always believed authors were observers, recorders of the world around them. They sit on the edge of horror and simply describe it. They don't cause it. They don't control it. They just write. At least, that's what I used to believe. Until I found out one of them was writing our reality. His name is Calvin Marin, best-selling author, Pulitzer finalist, master of the modern true crime thriller, and the man who, for the last 15 years, has quietly become the ghost architect of our nightmares. I used to admire him. Hell, I even based one of my fictional killers off the villains in his novels. He had that razor-sharp style that made every scene feel like you were there. Bleeding, hiding, running. I never imagined the blood might have been real. I came across Calvin's name while scanning the metadata on the USB drive Jules gave me, buried in the Ivy Thorn files. Under a folder titled Echo Players was a contract, a financial agreement, royalties, film rights, consulting fees. And there, in bold, was his name. Calvin Marin paid $140. $0 by a private trust to develop character concepts and narrative arcs. I nearly dropped my laptop. This wasn't fiction. It was scripted laundering. Here's what I pieced together. Certain members of this syndicate, Ronan Vale, Ivy Thorne, others I haven't even uncovered yet, had their lives, or versions of their crimes, embedded into popular media, books, streaming series, dramatized podcasts, all under the guise of creative liberties, all carefully fictionalized enough to slip past legal consequences. And Calvin? He was the middleman. The man who turned real evil into true stories the public couldn't get enough of. The irony? He called it ethically inspired fiction, a term he coined in a TED Talk 5 years ago. I went deeper. Tracked publishing credits, cross-referenced editors, ghostwriters, optioned production companies. It all came back to a single LLC in Delaware, Narrative Echo Holdings. Shell company. No physical address. Dozens of intellectual property copyrights and linked directly to an offshore account in the Seychelles. That was it. The bridge between financial crimes and public entertainment. Between blood in boardrooms and bingeable stories. And sitting on the board? Calvin. Fucking. Marin. I felt sick. like I was choking on every story I'd ever read, every based on true events book I ever reviewed, every podcast I praised without realizing I was feeding the machine. Was this how financial corruption stayed invisible? Not by hiding in the dark, but by flooding the world with carefully managed narratives? By releasing just enough truth to feel dangerous, but never enough to cause damage? I reached out to Calvin. I didn't expect him to reply, but he did. Email from Kamirani Narrative Echo. Com subject: You already know. I wondered when you'd connect the dots. You have talent. Precision. That's why we watched you. You could have been one of us. But you chose truth. That's a lonely road. Be careful. The stories you're telling now, they don't end well. I didn't sleep that night. I kept replaying his message in my head. He didn't deny it. He confirmed it. Not with guilt, but with a threat wrapped in flattery. And that terrified me more than any monster I'd ever invented. I decided to pull every one of my fictional episodes offline. Not out of fear, out of clarity. These weren't stories anymore. They were evidence. Each one, a breadcrumb leading deeper into the syndicate's hidden world. A network that pays writers to veil atrocities, repackages sinister cases as fiction, and profits off the very victims they destroy. They aren't scared of exposure. They own exposure. But I wasn't ready to run. Not yet. Because there was one name I hadn't looked into. The name that kept appearing in contracts and hard drive logs. A name I never wrote into any story. The Widowmaker. She wasn't a character. She wasn't in any book. She wasn't even online. But her digital fingerprints were everywhere. Encrypted messages. Blackmailed sources. Deleted evidence. Whoever she was, she wasn't just part of the syndicate. She ran it. And according to the next folder Jules had labeled for me, she was the next face I'd meet, the Bertie Stauns. The Widowmaker's mask. I didn't say her name out loud. Not once. Even when I was alone with my walls painted in post-its and paranoia. Even when I whispered everything else to myself. Ronan Vale. Ivy Thorne. Calvin Marin. Like a ritual. Like saying their names gave me control. The Widowmaker was different. She didn't feel like a character. She felt like a void. A black space in the middle of a blood-stained map that everyone knew to walk around. Because if you didn't, you wouldn't come back. But I didn't have a choice anymore. Because now I wasn't just uncovering secrets. I was being hunted by them. It started with the man in the elevator. I was heading up to the public records office downtown. Not even thinking. Just following a lead buried in a Cayman Islands property lease. He was already inside when I stepped in. Black coat. No phone. No eye contact. But I could feel it. The weight of recognition. And just as the doors closed behind me, he spoke low, like someone reciting a prayer in reverse. She said to tell you, stop dragging your microphone through graves. The Widowmaker prefers her silence clean. Then he smiled. Not like a person, like a warning. He stepped off at the third floor. I rode to the eighth, heart hammering against my ribcage like it wanted out. That night, I went dark. No phone. No internet. No lights. I pulled my mattress into the closet and slept with a kitchen knife under my pillow. Not because I thought it would help, but because fear makes you do rituals that feel useful even when they aren't. The next morning, I did something I hadn't done since this whole thing began. I called my mother. She didn't answer at first. But when she did, her voice cracked like she hadn't used it in days. Is it about that podcast again? I almost broke. But I said yes. And then, for the first time in years, she told me something I never expected. You know, your father used to talk about her before he disappeared. That stopped me cold. My father died in what we were told was an accident. A boating mishap. Closed case. Nothing suspicious. But suddenly, memories started flashing like crime scene photos. A sealed casket. No autopsy report. A bank account with $600,000 mysteriously emptied 2 weeks before. And a shredded notebook I found behind his filing cabinet labeled WM. The Widowmaker. She wasn't just some abstract queenpin of a criminal underground. She was real. And she was tied to me. I needed to know more. So I made the stupidest decision of my life. I logged back in. Encrypted laptop. Clean network. Proxy chains buried 6 layers deep. And there, waiting in the shadows of a dark web Dropbox I'd bookmarked a year ago, was a message. Time-stamped only hours ago. Heard you were looking for me. Bad idea. But brave. One journalist I respected. Your father. His silence was elegant. Try to be like him. Attached was a single file. A zipped folder named Red Tape Museum. Inside, decades of financial crimes. Ties between media conglomerates and criminal trusts. Bribes laundered through charity auctions. Backdoor campaign funding run through fake writing grants, and all of it signed off with her initials. W. M. She didn't just run the syndicate. She curated it. Like a collector of atrocities wrapped in artistic packaging, you've probably heard her quotes in podcasts, read her scripts in award-winning documentaries, listen to the shows her influencers bankroll on Spotify. Hell, you might have liked her posts on Bookstagram without even knowing who she was. That's how it works. The most dangerous people don't hide in the shadows. They run the spotlights. After I opened the file, I didn't sleep. Couldn't. I just sat there. The cursor blinking in front of me like a countdown. I realized something that night. This wasn't about Ronan Vale. Or Ivy Thorne. Or even Calvin Marin. Those were pawns. Performers in a dark opera written by a woman who never needed to be seen, because she owned the script. And now, I was rewriting it. The next morning, someone broke into my apartment. I knew it the second I walked in. Nothing was taken. No drawers rifled. No obvious damage. Just a single pair of earbuds left on my desk, still warm, and a note. You don't know what silence costs. That's when I made the decision. I wouldn't release the full story yet. Not until I had everything. Because I wasn't just going after a villain. I was going after the writer of the world's worst stories. And before I confronted her, I needed to find the one person who could prove she existed. A source buried so deep. He disappeared after whistleblowing on a global financial leak tied to offshore accounts. A man known only as the Archivist. He vanished years ago. But if the whispers I was chasing were right, he was alive, and he was waiting in the last place anyone would think to look, the Archivist's vault. They said the Archivist was dead. Officially, he was last seen in Berlin, 2019, fleeing a journalism conference after leaked footage exposed a massive data breach implicating 3 world banks, 2 humanitarian NGOs, and a former UN official. Unofficially, they said he went underground, into the earth, into the vault, a digital bunker rumored to house files so volatile, even major intelligence networks avoid them. I didn't believe the stories, until one of them pointed to me. It started with an email from an untraceable server. You'll find him where the servers hum louder than the lies. Below that, GPS coordinates, a forest in northern Vermont. I knew this was a trap. It had to be. No address, no name, no promise of help, just a place. But when you're chasing the devil's fingerprints, sometimes you follow the smoke and pray the fire doesn't burn you alive. So I went. It was 3 hours of back roads and a half-mile hike through wet pine needles and fog. I found the door behind a rusted generator shack, hidden under a carpet of moss and broken branches. It wasn't locked. It was watching. The staircase dropped 50 feet underground. No signs. No power. Just cold air and walls that wept condensation like the place was alive. At the bottom, a room. Circular. Silent. And glowing faintly blue. And in the center, him. He looked older than I expected. Gaunt. Pale. Beard like ash. He didn't speak at first. Just stared at me like I was a hallucination. Then finally, you're the girl with the podcast. You shouldn't be here. They'll find you. I told him about the Widowmaker, about Calvin Marin, about the fictional stories becoming real bodies. He didn't blink. Instead, he turned to a wall lined with hard drives and pulled one marked FF E Phasedo, Fictional Faces of Evil. They'd planned this before me, before the podcast, before I ever hit record. The archivist showed me something I still haven't recovered from, a blueprint, not of a story, but of a strategic cultural campaign. Each fictional villain I thought I'd created, they were already assigned to upcoming releases, streaming platforms, book launches, mini docuseries. The stories weren't born from observation. They were engineered. Fiction was never fiction. It was predictive laundering. Here's how it worked. Real crimes were sanitized through entertainment. Key players were renamed, dramatized, and sold back to the public. Financial trails were obscured by performance rights and narrative licensing. They didn't just bury bodies. They licensed them, copyrighted their deaths, filed them away behind red tape and narrative IP clauses. And the public? They ate it up. Streaming, liking, sharing, quoting. While offshore accounts ballooned quietly in the background, the archivist was shaking as he showed me one final document. They call it the Pantheon model. You're not just uncovering crimes. You're messing with mythology. They've built an empire of fiction so dense, reality drowns in it. He handed me the hard drive. Take this. But leave Vermont. Tonight. You publish this. They'll erase you. I wanted to argue, to promise I could protect him. But then he said something I still hear every time I press record. Don't become the next story they sell. Be the one they can't. I left at dawn. As I drove back toward civilization, I realized the highway signs felt foreign. The trees unnatural. It was like coming up from a fever dream. I had something in the trunk of my car that could blow a hole through the syndicate's media fortress. Proof of financial crimes, intentional disinformation, abuse of narrative power, and a worldwide operation that weaponized fiction to silence truth. But I also knew they were watching. 2 days later, a burner phone showed up on my porch. No return address. Just one contact saved. W. M. I haven't called it. Yet. But I will. Because the next episode I record, it won't be on Fictional Faces of Evil. It won't be behind a paywall. It won't be sold to streaming platforms for adaptation. It will be the raw, unedited truth. And when I release it, the shadows of justice will finally be seen in the light when the fiction fights back. I always believed that if I ever got to the truth, the real truth, I'd feel relief. That the weight pressing against my chest would finally lift, that people would care, that justice would arrive like a cavalry. But the truth is, they don't fear exposure. They fear chaos, and I was about to give it to them. I spent 5 days decoding the archivist's drive. It was worse than I imagined. Documents, voice memos, internal chat logs, all tied to the campaign I accidentally named, Fictional Faces of Evil, Phase 2. There were email threads between Calvin Marin and legal teams at three major networks, outlines for docuseries releases that matched the fictional characters I thought I created. One memo chilled me to the core. Public desensitization is 78% complete. Phase 3 greenlit upon successful public framing of the narrator as unreliable, unstable. Primary directive, discredit via mental health narrative if leak occurs. They weren't just covering their tracks. They were planning my fall. The moment I uploaded my findings to three mirrored servers, the retaliation began. First, I was locked out of my bank account. Then my car was repossessed over a clerical error. Then came the sponsored smear campaign. Articles across five lifestyle blogs claiming I fabricated interviews, that I had a history of manic episodes, that I'd once faked an assault for sympathy. All fake, all planted, all paid for. And worst of all, it worked. The comment sections lit up. People I thought were loyal followers said they felt duped. Even Bookstagram threads turned on me. She's lost it. Just another trauma grifter. This is why I stick to fiction. I didn't care about my reputation. I cared about what came next. Because while the public was debating my sanity, the Widowmaker made her move. It was subtle at first. The burner phone buzzing. A voicemail. No voice. Just the sound of waves crashing and a soft humming. Like a lullaby. Then a package. Wrapped in black velvet. Inside, a framed photo. Me. And my father, taken the week before he disappeared. Neither of us remembered it being taken. On the back, a handwritten note. He begged me to let you grow up normal. Don't make his sacrifice meaningless. My fingers shook as I held it. Not from fear. From rage. Because I finally understood what this was. A war over who gets to own the narrative. And for the first time, I refused to be written. So I recorded the episode. Not just an upload. A detonation. I named names. I showed receipts. I read emails. I played voice memos. I unveiled the network for what it really was. A story farm built to launder real-world abuse into profitable content. I told the audience exactly how financial scams were scripted to feel entertaining. How offshore accounts funded the very platforms they streamed on. How true crime stories were recycled from sealed court files and repackaged as fiction. And I ended it with this. This isn't a podcast. This is a warning. Every time you consume entertainment without questioning it, you're funding your own manipulation. You've loved the villains. Now meet the authors. I scheduled the episode to drop at 3:33 a.m., a time I'd once read was the witching hour of systems. And then, silence. I don't know how long I blacked out. But when I came to, my laptop was dead, my power out. The hard drives smashed on the floor, like someone wanted me to know they were close, but not finished. And then I saw the live comments, thousands of them, streaming in like a flood. She's right. My brother worked for one of the foundations she mentioned. My aunt was silenced after she tried to report a media exec. Ivy Thorne is real. I met her. And that's when I knew. They couldn't contain it anymore. The fiction had fought back. But it lost control. Because truth spreads fastest when it's already in the bloodstream. And the public? They'd been bleeding for years. They just didn't know where it came from. That night, I went dark. For good. I left my apartment. Ditched every device. Burned every notebook. And now, I'm somewhere quiet. Somewhere without screens. Somewhere safe, for now. But I know I can't stay hidden forever. Because I'm not just a narrator anymore. I'm a trigger. And whether I survive this or not, one thing is certain. The next time you hear a fictional podcast, or binge a new true crime docuseries, or post your theories about some killer with a catchy name, ask yourself, who profits from the story? Because the Widowmaker's greatest trick wasn't killing her victims, it was making them marketable.